Rabbi Karma, is it okay if I just want to...
Yeah.
Ready?
Good.
Hey, I appreciate the opportunity. We're accustomed to Hanukkah time having these lectures in Hellenism and Judaism. They're given in different ways. Professor Feldman, who's living to be well, every couple of years would give this kind of lecture. And he actually knew something about Greek culture, so made it very interesting. He also knew something about the history of the Hasmonean period. These are two separate things. One question is the history of Hanukkah, which what went on in Judea in the crucial years in the second century before the Common Era. The other question is, what does Hellenism stand for in general? Now, very often, the lectures that one hears around this time of year, sometimes with people less erudite and less precise than Professor Feldman, which means almost anybody, but we'll talk about the history fairly competently, and when they talk about culture, you very often wonder whether they really know exactly what they're talking about, because you have some idea of the musaf you want to give, and once you know what the musaf you want to give, you let Hellenism play whatever role you want it to play. In terms of the cultural discussion, probably the most impressive thing that I heard was a shiur that Rabbi Ravi Lichtenstein gave during the Chanukah Giga about 40-some-odd years ago, where he really discussed Hellenism and Judaism, going through various debates and scholarship of the Hellenistic period and what exactly Greek culture stands for. The other Shishib were sitting there, I don't know what they made of it, and especially he agrees with Nietzsche's interpretation of Sophocles opposed to other interpretations. And finally, when he finished that first half, and he went on to discuss Rabbi Daniel Lubavli's Shita about Hallel and Hanukkah, I think they calmed down a little bit. What's interesting here is, if you want to read together the piece by Rav Huttner, which doesn't fit any of these categories, it's not about Hellenism, it's about Yahadut, which Rav Huttner actually knew something about. And there is no attempt to pretend some kind of expertise in Greek culture that he may or may not have had. And nevertheless, it is relevant to some of these more general issues of what Greek culture is about, what Yahadut is about, where they intersect, and where they may appear to intersect but don't really intersect. Does everybody know what Rav Huttner was? 1906 to 1980. Came from Poland, was known as Warszawa Ilui, came from Warsaw. Studied in a variety of settings, Slobodka Yeshiva in Poland, the Chevron Yeshiva, which was a branch of Slobodka in Chevron. He was very close to Rav Kook. There's a story which I, among other people, repeated that Rav Huttner life was saved during the pogrom in 1929 because he was spending that Shabbos with Rav Kook. I recently learned that Rav Huttner was not in Palestine that Shabbos, so that story is off. Spent a little time at University of Berlin, clear exactly what he did there. Eventually, he took over Yeshivat Chaim Berlin in Brooklyn and became celebrated there as a molder of men, as a person who worked in the tradition of Slobodka Yeshiva, as a Musa Yeshiva, but who combined that kind of Musa with a very strong orientation to Machshavat Yisrael, in particular Maharal, whom he felt very, very close to. And the Kollel was called Gur Aryeh after Maharal. And to certain elements in Hasidic literature, which he doesn't quote that often, but which play a role. He was known for his ma'amarim, his various discourses he gave in Yeshiva, connected with various Yom Tovim, and the bulk of his publication comes from those ma'amarim. The second volume to appear was in Hanukkah, a fairly thin volume, and we will be reading the first Ma'amar in the Pachad Yitzchak on Hanukkah. Let's go over it and see what he's saying, and then we'll see whatever I have to add to it. Now, Putner's opening is about the nature of Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. This is a theme that may not play a chief role in medieval Jewish thought, but I think in modern Jewish thought, it's a kind of question we think about, and if we don't, we ought to think about it, because our study of Torah, Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaal Peh, Christians have a written Bible, the specific idea of Torah Shebaal Peh, somewhat alien to people who are not, who are coming from outside rather than from inside. His feelings about Torah Shebaal Peh, something added to Torah Shebichtav. We don't quite know how it fits in our religious experience. So there are things that are written and there are things that were not written. You should be aware that in Chazal, there is a notion that the things that are written should not be recited Baal Peh, should not be studied orally, and vice versa, and more important for us now, the things that were not written were not supposed to be written. There was some kind of detriment to taking Torah Shebichtav, Baal Peh, and writing it down. Our writing down of the Mishnah, of the Gemara, of Rishonim, Achronim, at least the Mishnah, is a concession to some kind of weakness. Eit lasot l'Hashem eferu Torotecha, there are situations where one must overcome the strict letter of the law and do things that you otherwise wouldn't do, which means writing down Torah Shebaal Peh, writing down Mishnah. To us, it's very strange, as we write everything, unless we record it. Everything is written down. But and in the course of history, in effect, the borderline Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh has moved, whereas more and more is in writing. And the question you can ask yourself, is there any remnant, is there any vestige of that idea of Torah Shebaal Peh that certain things should be oral? In any event, the Putner continues and mentions the Gemara in Yuma. Esther is compared to sunrise. Sunrise is the end of the night. Esther is the end of all miracles. Megillah is the last miracle in Tznach. And Gemara asks, what about Chanukah? And Gemara answers, we're only talking about the things that were written down, which means the Megillah was supposed to be written down, and Chanukah was not supposed to be written down. The Putner continues, we're talking about miracles. It seems there are two separate concepts. One concept is talking about miracles, and the other concept revolves around writing. What do miracles and writing have to do with each other? Why should you say some miracles should be written down, some should not be written down? I can understand better if you would say some jokes should be written down, some jokes shouldn't be written down. I could imagine somebody saying that the list of Marimakomot for a shir should be written down. There's no point in dictating it. And that some of the subtle ideas should be transmitted face to face. But why this particular division? So Putnam goes on, V'adaya kavanai divrei Torah she'echim l'ischanukah l'unchni l'katev. It doesn't just mean that Hanukkah wasn't written down. It means that there's something about Hanukkah that should not have been written down. There's some kind of connection between these two ideas, because Hanukkah is not really part of Kitvei Kodesh, the written Torah. Hanukkah belongs to oral Torah, not to written Torah. But now, let's try to understand, Rav Huttner says, what does it really mean that something is written down or not written down? Paragraph 2. The Pasuk in Hoshea says, Echtov lo rubei torati, chmo zar nechshavu. I write down the multitude of words of Torah, it is alienating. It becomes foreign. That implies that the writing of Torah Shebaal Peh could create an estrangement between Knesset Yisrael and the Ribono Shel Olam. Writing it then creates estrangements. And he quotes Midrash found in Tosfot and Gittin that the Umot HaOlam will someday write down the Torah. They will have translation, they will have it in writing, and if Torah Shebaal Peh would be in writing as well, they would write that down as well, and that would be a bad thing. It would be a bad thing. Why is it a bad thing? Midrash continues, Lokarat Kadosh Baruch Hu Brit in Israel, Ela al Divrei Torah Shebaal Peh Bilvad. The Brit between God and Klal Yisrael revolves around the oral Torah. I think most people who know this Gemara, who know these Midrashim, do not underline the word Brit. You would paraphrase, you would say, well, Torah Shebaal Peh is unique to Am Yisrael, Torah Shebaal Peh is very important for Am Yisrael. We'll give all kinds of paraphrases. But Rav Huttner underlines that word Brit, which is a word that most of us don't really pay attention to. Maybe you do, but certainly when I was your age, I didn't. He continues, every Brit involves the exclusion of those who are not part of the Brit. There's certain ethical values universal, apply to all human beings. There's also something called a covenant. And a covenant means there's an agreement between me and you. And by definition, that excludes other people. In theory, you could have a very large covenant that would actually include everybody, but even if you had such a covenant, it would still, by its very nature, be exclusive. I know Christian theologians would really think in those terms that Christianity potentially includes everybody, but they would still view it as a covenant. They would not view it as some kind of universal imperative, some universal community that defines you simply as a human being. It defines you as a member of a particular kind of community, a particular kind of Brit, except that community is does not have any limits. But the reality is that the very concept of Brit involves that idea, those who are in, those who are not in. Even expand those borders involves that. So those who are members and those who are not members. Gam Brit HaTorah shekarat HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael kolelet betucha miniat sheichut kazo. There is something in our Brit, the Ribono Shel Olam, that involves an element of exclusiveness. And that, Rav Huttner says, is the fact that not everything is in writing. There is something that goes on Baal Peh. Now here, let me let a couple beans out of the bag in terms of where I want to go with this. You can take a phenomenon we've spoken to until now, the idea that Dvarim Shebaal Peh involve an element of exclusion, because not everybody can go to a library and read it. You could say that that's essentially a necessity of any kind of community. Whatever human communication is about, there will always be things that cannot be written down. You write down the laws of baseball, there will still be things that can only be transmitted by Peh, only by experience. I mean, rules will tell you what happens, let's say, when the so-called neighborhood play, when you turn the women, I apologize if you're not into baseball. Although, you know, how can you stand obsessing now with that one? But, and I once said something that somebody had stirred, but not for now. Use an analogy of baseball, and she didn't follow it. Brilliant person. But
we watched baseball.
What?
Yeah, we watched baseball.
Yeah, but she couldn't. I mentioned a name, you'll know who it is. Very accomplished person. But anyway, getting back to where we are, the question of a neighborhood play, second baseman, it's a kind of thing which if you grow up with baseball, you know that people do it, but you wouldn't necessarily find it in the rule book. See, that's the way the world works. You're a congressman. There are rules about how Congress works. But there's a lot of stuff that you don't really understand until you watched it, until you've been trained. If you say that, then you can understand that the Jewish people is a certain relationship with God. Not everything can be written down. And Tosh Baal Peh symbolizes that. That's one way of reading. That is not the way Rav Huttner is going to read. It's not a claim in favor of unwritten tradition. Something else. Let him continue in his own words. Birkat HaTorah potachet b'shnayim. There are two brachot we make. Asher bachar banu, we call amin, benatan banu etorato. And the Gra explained that they're two separate issues. Chira is was told to Moshe that Am Yisrael be separate from all the nations. And then there's actually the giving of the content of the Torah. The Brit in Israel existed for four whole days before there actually was a Torah. So you see from here that there's a concept of covenant, there's a concept of exclusive relationship that occurs before the Torah is actually delivered. Since the Brit includes the negation of writing Torah Shebaal Peh, part of the ground rules are that certain things are written, certain things are not written. And we see that the concept of Dvarim Shebaal Peh, Yetar Asher Mon Bechtav, precedes conceptually the whole idea of the Torah. Al Pi HaDvarim Ha'ele, Chazal say that means Torah Shebaal Peh, based on these words, Karati Yitcha Brit Bet Yisrael. The underlining of the word Brit. La'od, kodem, kodem, afilu gufum urash matan Torah. The prohibition of writing the Torah Shebaal Peh is not isur prati. It's not some particular halacha among the other laws of the Torah. It's a kind of ground rule. It's viut surah. It is something that determines the very shape of that relationship between Am Yisrael and Rabbanu Shlom. Again, this is fairly nice drush, but then he takes another step which brings us very close to the real world of the Beit Midrash. We actually study Gemara. One of the things we notice in Gemara is that even when you're learning Gemara, the Gemara, and it's written down, the Gemara is not self-interpreting the way a newspaper is expected to be self-interpreting. You read the Mishnah, and the Mishnah is not transparent. You've got all, I remember my uncle taught in the Talmud Torah, no days before the any day schools. And there was one student there who was actually interested in what they were doing, and he was willing to continue studying after Bar Mitzvah. So my uncle was prepared to teach him a little Talmud. After a couple of weeks, he meets the girl's mother, the boy's mother, in the street. He asks her, "How's your son finding Talmud?" And woman said, "Well, he said the Mishnah is okay, but the Gemara is always looking for trouble." And he says the Mishnah is also, well, you know, if you leave the Mishnah alone, it's just opaque. And the Gemara has no choice but to look for trouble. You find the Mishnah, well, the Gemara will explain, the Mishnah is referring to this case, not to that case. Chasuri Mechsera, the Mishnah is written some kind of shorthand, where you have to fill in the words. In conversation, we know how this works. In conversation, very often we say things that don't make sense in writing. We use pronouns in very sloppy ways, and everybody understands what we mean. Unless if a comedian will go out of their way to misinterpret what you say. When you write it down, it's no longer clear. So you say, look, the Mishnah, in that respect, is like oral communication. But of Huttner, this is not just a statement of the history of the Mishnah. It's a statement about how Chazal created the text of Torah Shebaal Peh. Meaning that even when you're allowed to write it down, you're still keeping that oral element in it. Put it otherwise, when we say, Eit lasot l'shem etero toratecha, we say, there's certain necessities, you've got to write it down. That doesn't mean that that isur has now gone away. There's a situation sometimes in halacha where if it's an overriding factor, you ignore the prohibition. You just move ahead. But here, if that prohibition is not one local prohibition that can be trumped by something else, if that prohibition is part of the basic structure of the brit between God and Am Yisrael, then it's very hard to imagine that you would suspend that prohibition completely, that you would remove it without leaving a trace. And therefore, Rav Huttner says, the Gemara, even when it's written down, bears with it that imprint of the private intimacy of the Brit. Well, read this real quickly. Betoch kvalei sidur ha-mishnah nimsim ka'ele she'nam nirim klal k'masei sidur. There are elements in the Mishnah that are disorganized. If I may quote a Talmud of Rav Huttner, namely of Lichtenstein, started his career in Chaim Berlin and remained in communication with Rosh Hashiva until the end. He used the word disheveled. There's something disheveled about the Gemara. It's not organized. It's not like a law book. Ain't say the Mishnah Kisuri Mechsira, and Yimel comes Eshim Mekom Acher, serendipity. Things are found one place, and that found another place. Horun Rabotenu Bazek, he gam lachar shutra kivatash trashwapa, even now that you're writing it down. Eight lasot, you have to arrange it. Either write it down or organize it for writing. And I wonder whether Putner here was aware of the debate among academic Talmud scholars about whether Yehuda Nasi actually wrote the Mishnah or he just create a canonical form of Mishnah. Those who study history of Talmud know that there's some very strong views that maintain that the Mishnah continued to be studied orally until a much later time. So writing didn't really mean writing, it really meant creating an organized oral form. The debate was a word that, the Arabic word that I'm using, Perush Mishnah, which is often translated as writing, well, it really means writing or it means organizing, but it's not a lecture in Talmud, it's another time. They retained the oral structure, the oral setting. That even the written form will not be self-interpreting. And the writing will not replace the face-to-face communication. He said, if the whole idea here was it was an Issuk, any other Issuk, then once you suspend it, you suspend it completely. But if it's not, if it's really part of the structure, then it's important that aesthetically, in communication, its element be retained even at the after everything gets written down. Last page is Dalid. This distinction between the generality of Brit Torah and Dinei Torah themselves, meaning there's a structure of the Brit Torah and then there are the details of it, also is reflected in the idea of Mesirut Nefesh, question of martyrdom. There's martyrdom that we speak of when certain prohibitions require giving up your life rather than violating them. Most famous thing, talking about murder, rape, about Zara, give up your life rather than violate them. But it's another kind of Mesirut Nefesh, what the Gemara calls Arkata de Masana. Even if the Jewish practice, tire shoelace with this color shoelace, not that color shoelace, which is halachically completely insignificant, if that is something that your adversaries want to force you to do, then you give up your life even for that. What is the basis of that? The Putner says, in that case, if you're giving up your life for Arkadim Sana, you're not giving up your life for a halacha. The halacha itself is non-existent, it's not important. You're giving, and the fact that the guy is trying to force you to do it does not make it any more important or less important. What is important then? What's important is that maintaining the brit involves your insistence upon maintaining your own identity or separateness. Since Mesirut Nefesh and the mitzvah, Peshat Gzerat Shmad, is inherently different from Mesirut Nefesh when there's a particularly severe transgression that you're not willing to violate. And Chanukah is the day for that kind of Mesirut Nefesh. What's his argument for that? In Hey, let's go back to the beginning of our discussion. even regarding the story of the events themselves, lo nitznal v'katev, Hanukkah was not written down. Ki heim heim advarim, the mesirut nefesh of the Hashmonaim is not that they were willing to die for particular halachot, but they were willing to die for their Jewish identity. This, by the way, is an interesting perspective on the historical elements. Usually we think that Antiochus Epiphanes advocated idolatry, and the rebellion was based on idolatry. And a story in Cheshmonaim would be an eating pig, which is not Yehud B'Yavur under those circumstances. But Hortner is saying, however, that in his perspective in Hanukkah, it is not about a particular issue here or there. The real issue was, do you identify with the Greek polity, or do you remain separate from the Syrian Greek polity? Which means that for the purpose of this ma'amar, all the discussions about the differences between Aristotle's concept of ethics and Jewish concepts of ethics and the Jewish idea of tragedy and the Greek conception of tragedy and what Matthew Arnold wrote about his Hellenism versus Hebraism, the moral series versus aestheticism, all these issues are not the point for the book. Mesirut Nefesh was not about Aristotle's poetics. It was not about Aristotle's ethics. It was not about Sophocles. It was not about the things I discussed this week, a week and a half ago when I was here for Shabbos, about Sophocles' idea of tragedy versus salvation. It was very nice, but that's not what the Hortner is talking about. And I say this from a historical point of view, because from a historian's point of view, there's no reason to assume that the Hashmonaim knew anything about Greek culture, that they were interested in those aspects of culture. It's not at all clear that Antiochus Epiphanes wanted people to study Greek philosophy or Greek tragedy. He was interested in the kind of homogenization of the empire. As darshanim, we schlep in all these other philosophical conceptions. And maybe we're allowed to do it, maybe we're not allowed to do it, as part of our celebration of Hanukkah. Now, Hortner here is not getting into these philosophical issues. He's really sticking in a certain way to a narrow historical thesis. What Hanukkah was about was national separation, and he avoids saying that Hanukkah was about this halacha or that halacha, or this philosophy and that philosophy. It's an interesting point. Again, what he might say elsewhere is not my concern now. I'm a slow person. I read one thing at a time. So Mimela, because the Mesirut Nefesh of Hanukkah was about Jewish separation, not about particular content. Likewise, the message of Hanukkah, the story of Hanukkah, was not written down. It was left as a kind of Dvarim Shebaal Peh, at least within the Masada. And even within Torah Shebaal Peh, the Hortner says, Hanukkah does not play a large role. This is, again, another issue which many of you have heard about. I saw in the library, somebody was reading up on the story. I saw several books, which I assume were being used because they were relevant in the Yoma, which is why Chazal don't spend much time on Hanukkah. And many theories have been developed about that. The Hortner here also is sticking with a very simple kind of theory, saying if Hanukkah is Dvarim Shebaal Peh, then even when you have a Mishnah, the Mishnah is only going to discuss it in a disorganized manner. In the halachot of Hanukkah, in our Gemara, or, you know, they come up derech agav in the course of discussing lighting candles on Shabbos, second Perek on Shabbos. And the other couple of reference to Hanukkah and Bava Kama, which are really offbeat. You know, the question of somebody bumping into somebody else in the street and causing damage, and the question of they're running to light Hanukkah, which is really a side point regarding Bikurim, if somebody brings it as late as Hanukkah. But that's another story. It's another discussion. Now, let me say what I want to add to this beyond just reading what we have here. The title I gave you included a reference to Plato. The Putner doesn't mention Plato. The Putner doesn't mention Hellenism. The enemy here is defined purely political terms. How did Plato get in here? But once I talk about Toshe Baal Peh, Plato is relevant. Plato held a very similar thesis to the one that Putner could have presented here. Plato held that philosophy should not be written down. Philosophy is really Dvarim Shebaal Peh. Phaedrus, Socrates is explicitly writing down philosophy is very much a b'diavad. It can be argued, and it has been argued, that Plato's entire style of writing, which is dialogue, is meant to capture something of real discussion. Not conclusions, but discussion. Particularly Socratic nothings. Plato's position had great impact on later thinkers. And there are many philosophers, if you wake them up 2 o'clock in the morning, you would ask them, what's more real, Baruch Shem Pen, Baruch Shem Chadav? If you woke them up 3 o'clock in the morning, they would ask you, well, is it... Are you asking about getting tenure, or are you asking about philosophy? And if you assured them, was that getting tenure, they would say, well, really, 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 Baal Peh is more important. Conversation is important. You ask them about professional advancement, then they'll say, well, you have to publish. Among Gdolei Yisrael, Torah Baal Peh has been defended on grounds very much like Plato's and probably with reference to Plato. You take the Hakdama of the Ketav HaKabbalah to Chumash, who's a 19th century commentator, and the title gives away that he's a very interesting relationship of Toshba Ketav and Toshba Baal Peh. And Ketav HaKabbalah says, when you communicate with people, there's a lot that people can pick up through your gestures and your tone of voice. When you write it down, that is missing. That's why Torah Shebichtav is not self-sufficient. That's why the Torah Shebichtav includes all these hints that enable Chazal to build up a larger the thesis is, communication is subtle, writing is not adequately refined, so to get all the full meaning, you need something beyond the written form. And Torah Shebaal Peh and methodology Midrash Halacha supplies that. You want to look at other people written, I got to check the article, but there's a lot written on the whole subject. Many years ago, there was an article in Sinai by Reb Michal Katz, who was a Rosh Yeshiva of YU, later years taught Cholin here. Early in his career, he wrote an article in the Journal of Sinai about why Dvarim Shavah Pe'yet HaRashalim Lichtav, why are you not allowed to write down? And he surveyed several other options, but many of them, much of it revolves around the point he made now. In effect, Plato's points. Those of you who are up to date in these matters, and up to date means that you're only 30 years behind the times. So, anybody here know a philosopher named Jacques Derrida? A Frenchman? So my colleagues would not consider him a philosopher, but I... Derrida, in effect, argued against Plato. He said, you know, in reality, Dvarim Shebaal Peh are also not transparent. Speech is not really more transparent than writing because speech also is interpretation that by the time we move on, it dies in the very moment of communication. The book is called Speech and Phenomenon, but he's written about this a lot in his later writings. So that's the model that you get from Plato, which had an impact on Jewish thought. The Hutner is not going that way. The Hutner seems that way. He's saying what's distinctive for Klal Yisrael is Brit and Baal Peh, but the Hutner is focusing not on the mode of communication, he's focusing on the idea of intimacy and exclusivity. If you look at it from far away, and if you're sloppy about it, you can say, well, one thing is connected with the other. You understand very well that the kind of person who wants everything to be in writing is the kind of person who, A, will not be in sympathy with Hutner's idea of exclusivity, and that person will also not be in sympathy with Plato or the Kitab HaKabbalah's idea that oral communication, that written communication is flawed. They don't want it to be flawed. They want it to be something you can just transmit, and all over the world, people will read the same books and they'll be passing the same laws. The two ideas go together, culturally speaking. The same kind of people will be very sensitive to the oral nature of wisdom, to the fragile nature of communication, other people also value, at the social level, the intimacy and exclusivity of social relations. But the two ideas, nevertheless, are separate. They're distinct, but not disjunct. And what's important to me in terms of what we're getting out of this ma'amar is that Hutner could very, very easily have said, given the kind of drasha that he did not give, it'd be easier to do it, it'd be more cliched to do it, but he didn't do that. He chose to emphasize the word brit, emphasize not just the communicative issue, the philosophy language issue, but the social philosophy issue. In doing so, the Hutner is also placing a greater emphasis, and I think most prominent Jewish thinkers have placed, upon the notion of Bechirat Yisrael. If you look at medieval Jewish thought, and it's not that people didn't believe in Bechirat Yisrael, but it was not a central philosophical preoccupation. Read the Rambam. It's not in the Gimli Kriyamuna of the Rambam. It's something that comes up and takes for granted, but it's not an issue that he fights on. That issue he puts in the center. Yeah, of course you can. Somebody gave a course in Creative Bestow a few years ago. I was there. Had to be there because I was getting it. And you can find enough in Rishonim, Rambam, the Levi, Ramban. Just go through Mefarshim and Tanakh. You go through Chazal, then clearly Creative Bestow will play an important role. But it was not a philosophical preoccupation. The same way Torah Shebaal Peh was not a philosophical preoccupation. The modern world, the last 200 years, what it means to be separate from other nations, particularly in the age of emancipation, an age of universalism and philosophy, that issue became very, very central. And Rav Huttner is picking that up. That's an important thing, but it becomes more important when you're challenged on it, when you realize this is really bothering people, when people really have to struggle to define who they are and what they're all about. So, to sum up, what we have here, this double focus for the Huttner, one on the idea of Torah Shebaal Peh, being connected with Brit, the other, the notion of Mesirut Nefesh, the idea that Mesirut Nefesh sometimes involves not the content of Torah, but the very act of separation. And he may be hinting that in our generation, that basic issue of identity may be extremely important. What we saw is that there's several ways that he could have developed these ideas, particularly the Platonic way. He chose not to do that. And lastly, by doing so, go back to the beginning, he redeemed, so to speak, the concept of Brit, which for many people, we could talk about Bechirat Yisrael, we could talk about Galam Yisrael, without necessarily focusing on the word Brit. And he brought the word Brit back into the center of the discussion, precisely because the Gemara darshins al pi advarim ha'ele, based on Torah Shebaal Peh, karati itcha brit in Israel. So he noticed that fine point in Chazal, and he was able to do something with that. Okay, if this is the way you learned the Ma'amad before, then I really didn't help you very much, but at least you got some pizza. And you know, if I did help you think about these issues and put things in perspective, I hope it will help you think about these issues and may also help you when you continue to read Rav Huttner or other thinkers who are similar to Rav Huttner in certain respects, that you'll be able to notice things that you may not have noticed as readily before.
If anybody is not on the club's email list and would like to be, there's a sign-in sheet or sign-up sheet in the back.